It looks like you're holding the cards, Ari said. Put your name on the list.
What about Karen?
That wasn't part of our deal.
I'm making a new deal.
Ari walked up to him and said, I don't like that, Dove. He towered over the boy threateningly. Dove backed up.
You can beat me. I've been beaten by experts. You can kill me. I'm not afraid. Nothing you do can scare me after the Germans.
Stop reciting Zionist propaganda to me, Ari said. Go to your tent and wait there. We'll give you an answer in 10 minutes. Dove unlocked the door and ran out.
The little bastard, David said.
Ari nodded quickly for David to leave the room. The instant the door closed, Kitty grabbed Ari by the shirt.
She isn't going on that ship. You swore it. She is not going on the Exodus.
Ari grabbed her wrists. I'm not even going to talk to you unless you get control of yourself. We've got too much to cope with without a hysterical woman. Kitty pulled her hands free with a fierce jerk. Now listen, Ari said. I didn't dream this up. The finish of this thing is less than 4 days off. That boy has us by the throat, and he knows it. We can't move unless he fixes those papers.
Talk to him. Promise anything. But keep Karen here.
I'd talk till I'm purple if I thought it would do any good.
Ben Kanan, please. He'll compromise. He won't insist on Karen's going.
Ari shook his head. I've seen hundreds of kids like him. They haven't left much in them that's human. His only link with decency is Karen. You know as well as I do he's going to be loyal to that girl. Kitty leaned against the blackboard where the words, The Balfour Declaration of 1917 is the British Promise, were written. The chalk rubbed off on the shoulder of her dress. Ben Kanan was right. She knew it. Dov Landau was incorrigible, but he did have a strange loyalty for Karen. Mark had been right. She had been a damned fool. There is only one way, Ari said. You go to that girl and tell her the way you feel about her. Tell her why you want her to stay on Cyprus.
I can't, Kitty whispered. I can't.
She looked up at Ben Kanan with a pathetic expression. I didn't want anything like this to happen, Ari said. I am sorry, Kitty. It was the first time he had ever called her Kitty.
Take me back to Mark,
she said. They walked into the hall. Go to Dove, Ari said to David. Tell him that we agree to his terms. When Dove got the news, he rushed over to Karen's tent and burst in excitedly.
We are going to Palestine,
he cried.
Oh, dear,
was all that Karen could say.
Oh, dear. We must keep it quiet. You and I are the only ones among the children who know about it. When do we go? A few more days. Ben Kanan is bringing some trucks up. Everyone will be dressed like British soldiers. They are going to pretend to be taking us to the new camp near Larnaca. Oh, dear.
They went out of the tent, hand in hand. Dove looked out over the sea of canvas as he and Karen walked in and out among the acacia trees. They walked slowly toward the playground where Zev had a class of children practicing knife fighting. Dov Landau walked on alone along the barbed wire wall. He saw the British soldiers marching back and forth. Down the long wall of barbed wire there was a tower, and a machine gun, and a searchlight. Barbed wire, guns, soldiers. When had he been outside of barbed wire? It was so very long ago, it was hard to remember. Barbed wire, guns, soldiers. Was there a real life beyond them? Dove stood there and looked. Could he remember that far back? It was so long ago. So very long ago. Chapter 22. Warsaw, Poland. Summer, 1939. Mendel Landau was a modest Warsaw baker. In comparison with Dr. Johann Clement, he was at the opposite end of the world, socially, financially, intellectually. In fact, the two men would have had absolutely nothing in common except that they were both Jews. As Jews, each man had to find his own answer to the relationship between himself and the world around him. Dr. Clement clung to the ideals of assimilation up to the very end. Although Mendel Landau was a humble man, he had thought out the problem too, but had come to an entirely different conclusion. Mendel Landau, unlike Clement, had been made to feel an intruder. For 700 years, the Jews in Poland had been subjected to persecution of one kind or another, ranging from maltreatment to mass murder. The Jews came to Poland originally to escape the persecution of the Crusaders. They fled to Poland from Germany, Austria, and Bohemia before the sword of holy purification. Mendel Landau, like every Polish Jew, well knew what had followed the original flight of the Jews into Poland. They were accused of ritual murder and witchcraft, and were loathed as business competitors. An unbroken series of tribulations climaxed one Easter week when mobs ran through the streets dragging each Jew and his family from his home. Those who would not accept baptism were killed on the spot. There was a Jew's tax. Jews were forced to wear a yellow cloth badge to identify themselves as a race apart. 1,001 statutes and laws aimed at suppressing the Jews stood on the books. The Jews were moved into ghettos and walled in to keep them isolated from the society around them. In these ghettos, something strange happened. Instead of dying slowly, the faith and culture of the Jews deepened and their numbers multiplied. Sealed off forcibly as they were from the outside world, the Jews turned more and more to the laws of Moses for guidance, and these laws became a powerful binding force among them. Inside the ghetto, they governed themselves and developed closer-knit family and community ties, which continued even after the ghettos were outlawed. For those who ruled Poland, the ghetto was only part of the answer of how to deal with the Jews. Jews were prevented by law from owning land or belonging to dozens of trades and crafts in which they might offer significant economic competition. The Jews, locked in their ghettos, made ready scapegoats for any Polish disaster. Periodically, mobs, goaded by blind hatred and fed on fear, tore into the ghettos and killed and whipped the Jews and smashed their homes and belongings, until Jew-beating became an accepted, if not honorable, pastime of the Poles. 4 centuries of Jew-baiting came to a climax in 1648. During a Cossack uprising, 500,000 Jews were slaughtered. The frenzy of the slaughterers was such that Jewish infants were often thrown into open pits and buried alive. The Dark Ages, which came to an end in Western Europe, seemed to linger on over the Polish ghettos. The enormous tragedy of 1648, together with hundreds of years of continuous persecution, created strange phenomena within the ghetto walls. Throughout Jewish history, whenever events were black and hope all but vanished, 12 or so self-styled messiahs would arise among the people and proclaim themselves their saviors. In this darkest of moments after the 1648 massacres, a new group of messiahs stepped forward. Each claimed to have been sent in fulfillment of the prophecies of Isaiah. Each had a strong following. With the messiahs came the Jewish mystics, a cult dedicated to finding biblical explanations for the centuries of suffering. In their desperation for salvation, the mystics concocted weird interpretations of the Bible based on mysticism, numerology, and just plain wishful thinking. They hoped, through an involved system called the Kabbalah, to find a way for God to lead them from the wilderness of death. While the messiahs proclaimed themselves and the Kabbalists looked for hidden meanings, a third sect arose in the ghettos. The Hasidim, who withdrew from the rigors of normal life and lived only for study and prayer. By submerging themselves in prayer, they managed to lift themselves from the pain of reality into religious ecstasy. Messiahs, Kabbalists, Hasidim, all born of desperation. Mendel Landau knew all this. He also knew there had been periods of enlightenment when the burden eased and the laws relaxed. Poland's own history was blood-marked. The Poles had struggled for freedom in a series of wars, revolutions, and plays of power. Parts of Poland's borders were torn away, and there was always an invasion or the threat of invasion. During these Polish struggles, the Jews took up arms and fought alongside the Poles, placing the cause of the larger nation above their own. Much of what Mendel Landau knew was now ancient history. It was 1939, and Poland was a republic. He and his family no longer lived in a ghetto. There were over 3 million Jews in the country, and they formed a vital part of the national life. The oppression had not stopped with the formation of a republic. It only varied in degree. There was still unequal taxation for the Jews. There was still economic strangulation. The Jews continued to be blamed by most Poles for causing floods when it rained and drought when it was dry. The ghetto was gone, but to Mendel Landau, anywhere he lived in Poland was a ghetto. It was a republic, indeed, but since 1936, Mendel Landau had seen pogroms and anti-Jewish rioting in Brzeszcz, Częstochowa, Brzytyk, Minsk, Mazowiecki. And he knew the snarl of the hoodlums who specialized in smashing Jewish shops and cutting Jewish beards. And so, Mendel Landau and Johann Clement came to different conclusions. After 7 centuries in Poland, Mendel Landau was still an intruder, and he knew it. He was a simple and rather modest man. Leah, his wife, was the plainest of women, a hard-working and devoted mother and wife. Mendel Landau wanted something to give his children as a heritage. He did not have the fervor of the Hasidim for prayer, nor did he believe in messiahs or in the numerology of the Kabbalah. Mendel retained only a measure of faith in his religion. He kept the Jewish holidays as most Christians keep Easter and Christmas. He accepted the Bible for its historical value as a story of his people rather than as a basis for worship. And so he could not offer his children even a deeply rooted religion. What Mendel Landau gave his children was an idea. It was remote, and it was a dream, and it was unrealistic. He gave his children the idea that the Jews must someday return to Palestine and reestablish their ancient state. Only as a nation could they ever find equality. Mendel Landau worked hard as a baker. His world consisted of feeding a family and providing them with shelter, education, clothing, and love. He did not believe, in his wildest moments, that he would ever see Palestine. Nor did he believe his children would ever see Palestine. But he did believe in the idea. Mendel was not alone among the Polish Jews. Of Poland's 3.5 million Jews, there were hundreds of thousands who followed the same star, and from them spouted the wellspring of Zionism. There were religious Zionists, labor Zionists, small militant Zionist groups, and middle-class merchant Zionists. Because he was a trade unionist, Mendel's family belonged to a labor Zionist group who called themselves the Redeemers. The entire social life of the Landaus revolved around the Redeemers. From time to time, there were speakers from Palestine, there was recruiting work, there were books and pamphlets and discussions and songs and dances and endless hope to keep the idea alive. The Redeemers, like other Zionist groups, ran agricultural centers where boys and girls could be trained to work the land. And every so often, the Redeemers sent a group to Palestine to cultivate newly purchased land. There were 6 members of the Landau family. There were Mendel and his wife, Leah. There was the oldest son, Mundek, who was a strapping boy of 18 and a baker himself. Mundek was a natural leader and was a section head in the Redeemers. There were the 2 girls. Ruth, who was 17, was horribly shy, as Leah had been. She was in love with Jan, who was also a leader of the Redeemers. Rebecca was 14. And there was little Dov, who was the baby of the family. He was 10 and blonde and wide-eyed and actually too young to be a member of the Redeemers. He idolized his big brother Mundek, who patronizingly allowed him to tag along to meetings. September 1st, 1939. After manufacturing a series of border incidents, the Germans invaded Poland. Mendel Landau and his eldest son, Mundek, went into the army. The German Wehrmacht ripped Poland to shreds in a campaign that lasted only 26 days. Mendel Landau was killed in battle, along with more than 30,000 other Jewish soldiers who wore the uniform of Poland. The Landaus were not allowed the luxury of prolonged sorrow, for this was a time of peril. Mundek returned from the gallant but futile defense of Warsaw as head of the Landau family. The same moment the Germans entered Warsaw, the Redeemers met to discuss a course of action. Most of Poland's Jews, being more hopeful than realistic, felt nothing would happen to them and adopted a wait-and-see attitude. The Redeemers and other Zionist groups throughout Poland were not so naive. They were positive that grave danger lay ahead with Germans in occupation. The Redeemers and many of the other Zionist groups decided to stay together and to take group action which would be binding on them all. Some groups chose to flee to the illusion of safety in the Soviet Union, which had moved in to gobble up the eastern half of Poland when the Germans invaded. Other groups began an underground operation, and still others worked on the establishment of an underground railway for escape. The Redeemers voted to remain in Warsaw and build up resistance inside the city and remain in contact with other Redeemer groups throughout Poland. Mundek was voted the military leader, although he was not yet 19. Jan, Ruth's secret love, was made Mundek's second in command. The moment the Germans established themselves in power and Hans Frank became governor, an immediate series of laws were levied against the Jews. Worship, forbidden. Travel, limited. Taxation, excessive. Jews were thrown out of public office, civil or elective. Jews were barred from bread lines. Jews were barred from public places. Jews were taken out of schools. There was talk of a revival of the ghetto. With the restrictive laws, the Germans embarked upon a campaign of enlightenment for the Polish population. This campaign fostered the already prevalent opinion that the Jews had started the war, and the Germans claimed further that the Jews were responsible for the German invasion, which was designed to save Poland from Jewish Bolsheviks. Warsaw and the other cities were plastered with posters depicting bearded Jews violating nuns and other scenes of Jewish depravity. Beard cutting, profaning synagogues, and public indignities against the Jews were encouraged. Berlin, Germany. In Berlin, the top Nazi officials wrestled with the Jewish problem. Several theories were advanced. Heydrich, the SD chief, favored holding the Jews for ransom and then deporting them en masse. Schacht, the financial wizard, preferred a slow draining of the financial assets of the Jews. Many ideas were presented and discussed. An old plan of shipping all the Jews to the island of Madagascar was revived for consideration. Others would have preferred to send the Jews to Palestine, but the British blockade made that impossible. SS Colonel Eichmann had long done resettlement work among the Jews. He had been born in Palestine and spoke fluent Hebrew, and therefore seemed the most obvious man to be put in charge of the final solution of the Jewish problem. Headquarters were established at Kurfürstenstrasse 46. The first thing that was apparent was that until a final solution was reached, a mass resettlement program was called for. Most of the Nazis agreed that Poland was the natural place for resettlement. First, there were already 3.5 million Jews in Poland. Second, they would encounter little or no public indignation, as they would in Western Europe. Hans Frank, the German governor, objected to having more Jews dumped in Poland. He had tried to starve the Polish Jews, and he had shot and hanged as many as he could. But Frank was overruled by the top planners in Berlin. The Germans cast a dragnet all over Poland to catch the Jews. Raiding parties tore into villages and the smaller towns and rounded up the Jews at a moment's notice. They were packed onto freight trains, often without being able to take anything with them, and sent to the large population centers. A few Jews learned of the roundups in advance and either fled or tried to buy their way into Christian homes. Very few Poles ran the risk of harboring a Jew. Others extorted every penny from the Jews and then turned them over to the Germans for a reward. Once the Jews were resettled, an edict was issued ordering every Jew to wear a white armband bearing a Star of David. Poland wasn't like Denmark. The Poles made no objection to the edict, and the Jews wore the armband and the Star of David on their backs as well. Warsaw, winter, 1939. These were hard and bitter days for the Landau family. The death of Mendel Landau, renewed talk of reviving the ghetto, the resettlement program of the Germans, and the shortages made life very difficult. One morning, early in 1940, there was a knock on the door of the Landau home. Polish blue police who worked with the Germans were outside. They abruptly informed Leah Landau that she had 2 hours to pack her belongings and move to another section of Warsaw which had been set aside for the Jews. There would be no compensation for the house and barely time to gather together what Leah had saved in over 20 years of married life. The Landaus and all the rest of the Jews in Warsaw were resettled in an area in the center of the city near the main rail line. Mundek and Jan moved quickly and were able to get an entire 3-story building to serve as home and headquarters for over 100 members of the Redeemers. The Landau family of 5 had a single room furnished with cots and a pair of chairs. The bathroom and kitchen were shared with 10 other families. The Jews were pressed into a tiny area that ran only 12 blocks in length from Jerozolimska Street to the cemetery and was a bare 6 blocks wide. The Redeemers were situated in the Brushmakers district on Leszno Street. Leah had managed to hoard a few jewels and valuables, which might be useful later, although there was no immediate financial need, for Mundek continued to work as a baker, and the Redeemers pooled their food resources in a common kitchen. Jews from the provinces poured into Warsaw. They came in long lines, carrying all they were allowed to take in sacks or wheelbarrows or pushcarts. They unloaded in trainload after trainload at the siding near the Jews' quarters. The small area became packed. Jan's family moved in with the Landau family. There were 9 now in the single room. The romance between Ruth and Jan became an open secret. The Germans had the Jews set up a council to govern their area, but it quickly became an instrument for carrying out German orders. Other Jews who felt it better to go along with the Germans joined a special Jewish police force. The population in the compressed area swelled to over 500,000 people. At the end of 1940, 1 year after the conquest of Poland, the Germans put many thousands of Jews into forced labor battalions. A brick wall 10 feet high was built around the Jewish area in Warsaw. Barbed wire was strung atop the wall. The 15 exits were guarded by Polish blues and by Lithuanians. The ghetto had returned to Poland. Almost all traffic from the ghetto outside the wall ceased. Mundek, who had held a job on the outside, was now unemployed. Rations inside the ghetto were cut to a level that could barely feed half the population. The only families who seemed to stand a chance of obtaining food were those who held labor cards and worked in one of the dozen forced labor battalions or industries. The creation of the ghetto brought panic. Some Jews began to trade their fortunes for food, and some tried to escape to Christian homes. But most escape attempts ended in death or betrayal from the other side of the wall. Life inside the wall gradually became a day-to-day struggle to stay alive. Mundek Landau emerged as a leader. Because of his importance among the Redeemers, he obtained a license from the Jewish Council to run one of the few ghetto bakeries. Thus, through a continuation of united action, his group managed to keep alive and fed. All was not blackness inside the ghetto. A very fine symphony orchestra gave weekly concerts. Schools ran on schedule. Little theater groups were formed. There was always a choice of debates and lectures. A ghetto newspaper was printed, and ghetto money became a legal means of exchange. Secret religious services were held. The Redeemers played a major part in keeping these services and activities going. Although Little Dov wanted to be more active in the Redeemers, the rest of the Landau family forced him to get as much schooling as he could. March, 1941. 18 months after the invasion of Poland, the final decision for a solution of the Jewish problem was handed down by Adolf Hitler. The order was verbal. 6 weeks later, SD Chief Heydrich announced the Führer's decision at a secret conference of SS, SD, and other Nazi officials at Großwannsee. The final solution was genocide. SS Colonel Eichmann, the resettlement expert, was put in charge of eradicating the Jews from the face of Europe. Within a few months, the Einsatzkommandos, action commandos, were mobilized into Einsatzgruppen, special action groups, and they swept into Poland, the Baltics, and occupied Russian territory on their mission of genocide. The initial efforts of the special action groups followed a pattern. They rounded up Jews, took them to an isolated area, and forced them to dig their own graves. They stripped them and forced them to kneel beside their graves and shot them in the head. The climax of the activities of the Special Action Commandos took place in the Russian city of Kiev, in a suburb called Babi Yar, where 33,000 Jews were rounded up and shot over immense pits in a period of 2 days. The Einsatzgruppen had a great measure of success because there was no opposition from the local population, which, to some degree, shared the Germans' feelings toward the Jews. The massacre of Babi Yar was carried out midst the cheers of many approving Ukrainians. It became apparent that the methods of the Einsatzkommandos were not sufficient for the overall plan of genocide. Shooting was slow and clumsy. Furthermore, the Jews were not complying by starving to death in large enough numbers. Eichmann, Paul Blobel, Himmler, Streicher, and dozens of other top Nazis worked out a huge master plan. The plan called for careful selection of secluded sites near railheads and population centers. Camps to be built on these sites would be designed by the best engineers at the lowest cost so that the executions could be carried out on an assembly line basis. Top personnel from old established concentration camps inside Germany would be promoted to take over the new establishments. Winter, 1941. The Warsaw Ghetto saw death in numbers that eclipsed even those in the pits at Babi Yar. People by the tens and hundreds and thousands starved or froze to death. Infants too weak to cry died by the hundreds, and old men died by the hundreds too weak to pray. Every morning the streets of the ghetto were strewn with new corpses. The sanitation teams walked through the streets with shovels and stacked the corpses onto pushcarts. Infants, children, women, men, piled up and wheeled off to the crematoriums to be burned. Dov was now 11 years old. He quit school to prowl for food when Mundek's bakery was closed. Even groups like the Redeemers were in dire straits. Dov learned the tricks of staying alive in a ghetto. He moved about, listened, and acted with the cunning of a wily animal. The Landau kettle was empty for long periods of time. When none of the family or the Redeemers could get together a meal, Leah traded off a piece of her hoarded jewelry for food. It was a long and a cruel winter. Once, when they had gone for 5 days without food, the Landaus finally had a meal, but Leah's wedding band was missing from her hand. Then their fortunes took an upswing, for the Redeemers got hold of a horse. It was old and bony and forbidden by their religion as food, but it tasted wonderful. Ruth was 19. When she married Jan that winter, she was too thin to be really pretty. They spent their honeymoon in the single room they shared with the 4 other Landaus and 3 members of his family. But apparently the young couple was able to find some time alone somewhere, for in the springtime Ruth was pregnant. One of Mundek's major responsibilities as leader of the Redeemers was keeping contact with the outside. Money could be used to bribe the Polish Blue Guards and the Lithuanians, but Mundek reckoned that the money should be saved for more important things. He set out to establish routes in and out of the ghetto, under the wall, through the sewers. It was dangerous to go into Warsaw, for Polish hoodlum gangs were constantly on the lookout for escaped Jews to extort or turn in for reward money. The Redeemers had lost 5 members who had been caught beyond the wall. The last one, captured by hoodlums and turned over to the Gestapo and subsequently hanged, was Ruth's husband, Jan. Little Dov was wise to the ways of survival. He went to Mundek with the proposition that he be allowed to take up the job of courier through the sewers. Mundek would not hear of it at first, but Dov persisted. His blonde hair and blue eyes made him the least Jewish-looking of them all. He would be least suspect because of his age. Mundek knew that Dov was cagey and competent, but his heart would not let him let his younger brother do it. Then, when Mundek lost his 6th and 7th courier inside of a few days, he decided to let Dov have a try. Mundek reckoned that they all flirted with death each day anyhow. Leah understood and did not object. Dov proved to be the best courier in the ghetto. He established 12 alternate routes under the wall. He became at home in the fetid, slimy, putrid waters that ran beneath Warsaw. Each week Dov took that journey in the blackness through shoulder-high filth. Once under the wall, he made his way to an apartment at Zabrowska 99 to a woman he knew only as Wanda. After a meal, he would return to the sewer, carrying with him pistols, ammunition, money, radio parts, and news from other ghettos and from the partisans. When he wasn't making his weekly trip, Dov liked to stay at Redeemer headquarters, where Mundek and Rebecca spent most of their time. Rebecca's job was forging travel passes and passports. Dov liked to watch her, and soon began working along with her. It was not long before it was discovered that Dov had a remarkable aptitude for copying and duplicating. His eye was sharp and his hand was steady, and at the age of 12, he was soon the best forger among the Redeemers. Late Spring, 1942. The Germans took a significant step toward the final solution of the Jewish problem by erecting several camps designed for the carrying out of mass exterminations. To handle the Jews from the Warsaw area, 33 acres were set aside in a place secluded from general view, called Treblinka. 2 main buildings contained 13 gas chambers. There were quarters here for workers and German personnel, and there were enormous field plots for burning corpses. Treblinka, one of the first such camps, was a forerunner of more efficient models that followed. July, 1942. July brought a day of mourning for all Jews. Those in the Warsaw Ghetto and the other ghettos in Poland mourned perhaps more deeply than other Jews. It was the day of Tisha B'Av, an annual Jewish holiday commemorating the destruction of the temples by the Babylonians and Romans in Jerusalem. For the fall of Jerusalem to the Roman invaders nearly 2,000 years before had signaled the end of the Jews as a nation. The Jews were thenceforth dispersed to the far corners of the earth. They were, from that day on, a diaspora. Tisha B'Av, 1942, coincided with major steps in the final solution of the Jewish problem. As the Jews of Warsaw mourned both their ancient and present plight, German patrols whisked into the ghetto and stopped before the building housing the Jewish Council. To all outward appearances, the Germans seemed to be making another roundup for the forced labor battalions. But this time something sinister was in the air. For the Germans wanted only old people and very young people. Panic swept through the ghetto as oldsters were herded in and the Germans sought out children, most of whom were torn from their mother's arms. Those rounded up were gathered at the Umschlagplatz and then marched off to Stavki Street near the rail sidings, where a long line of freight cars stood in readiness. Dazed and shocked crowds gathered. Some frantic parents were kept separated from their children at gunpoint, and several times the Germans shot to kill. The children were laughing and singing. The German guards had promised them a picnic in the country. This was an event. Many of them could hardly remember being outside the ghetto. As the train rolled off toward Treblinka, the final solution was at hand. Tisha B'Av, 1942. 2 weeks later, Dov Landau came back from Wanda's apartment at Zabrowska 99 with a shocking report. The report stated that those who had been rounded up on Tisha B'Av and in five subsequent roundups had been sent off to death in gas chambers in a place called Treblinka. Further information from other ghettos around Poland reported the existence of other such camps. Belzec and Chełmno, in the Krakow area, and Majdanek, near the city of Lubin, were in operation or being readied. It appeared, said the report, that a dozen more camps were under construction. Mass murder in gas chambers? It did not seem possible. Mundek, as head of the Redeemers, met with half a dozen other Zionist groups in the ghetto and issued a joint decree for everyone to stage an immediate uprising and break through the wall. The plea was emotional rather than practical. The Jews had nothing to fight with. Furthermore, everyone who held a card in a labor battalion had convinced himself that it was a passport to life. The main reason that no uprising could be staged was that there was no support for it in Poland outside the ghetto. In France, the Vichy government had absolutely refused the Germans' demands that French Jews be turned over to them. In Holland, the unanimous feeling of all the citizens was to hide their Jews. In Denmark, the king not only defied German edicts, but the Danes evacuated their entire Jewish population to safety in Sweden. If the Poles did not agree to the extermination of their Jews, they did not disagree. If they disagreed, they did nothing to show it. Only a very small minority of Polish people would shelter an escaped Jew. Inside the ghetto, each different organized group of Jews embraced a different philosophy. The religious and the labor people argued. The conservatives and the left-wingers argued. Jews liked to argue. In ghetto life, argument and debate had always been a great pastime. But now the time of greatest peril had come. Mundek's Redeemers joined all the diversified groups in forming a unified command. The combined organizations carried the initials ZOB and had the momentous task of saving the rest of the Jews in the ghetto. Dov made one trip after another to Wanda's apartment at Zabrowska 99. On each trip through the sewers, he carried a message from ZOB to the Polish underground begging for help and for arms. Most of the messages were never answered. The few answers that were received were evasive. Throughout that horrible summer, while the Germans continued rounding up Jews for Treblinka, the ZOB worked desperately to stave off total annihilation. One day early in September, Dov had a particularly dangerous trip into Warsaw. After leaving Wanda's, he was spotted by four hooligans who chased him into a dead-end alley and demanded to see his papers proving he wasn't a Jew. The boy had his back to the wall, and his tormentors closed in on him to pull off his pants to see the circumcision, the sure identification of a Jew. As they set to pounce, Dope took out a pistol he was carrying back to the ghetto, and with it killed one of the hooligans and chased the others off. He darted away, and soon found the safety of the sewer. Back at Redeemer headquarters, the boy broke down under delayed shock. Mundek tried to comfort him. Dov always felt warm and wonderful with his brother near. Mundek was almost 21 now, but he was gaunt and always tired-looking. He had been a good leader, and he worked beyond the limits of exhaustion. He had kept almost the entire Redeemer group intact and had never let their fighting spirit flag. The brothers talked quietly. Dov calmed down. Mundek put his arm around Dov's shoulder, and they walked from headquarters to their apartment. Mundek talked about Ruth's baby, which was due in a few weeks, and how wonderful it was going to be for Dov to be an uncle. Of course, everyone in the Redeemers would be aunt and uncle to the baby, but Dov would be the real one. There had been many marriages in the group, and there were already three babies, all new Redeemers. Ruth's baby would be the finest of them all. Things were bright, Mundek told Dov, because they had found another horse and there would be a real feast. Dov's trembling passed away. As they neared the top of the stairs, Dov smiled at Mundek and told his brother that he loved him very much. The instant they opened the door and saw the expression on Rebecca's face, they knew disaster had struck. Mundek finally got his sister coherent enough to talk.
Mother and Ruth, she cried. They were taken out of the factory. Their work cards were invalidated, and they were marched off to the Umschlagplatz.
Dov wheeled around for the door. Mundek grabbed him. The boy screamed and kicked.
Dov, Dov, there is nothing we can do. Mama, Mama, I want to go to Mama. Dov, Dov. We can't look at her being taken away.
Ruth, 8 months pregnant, cheated the gas chambers of Treblinka. She died in the agony of childbirth, and her baby died with her, in a cattle car so packed it was impossible for her to lie down. At Treblinka, SS Colonel Wirth, the commandant, was furious. There had been another breakdown in the mechanism at the main gas chambers, and another trainload of Jews was en route from the Warsaw ghetto. Wirth had been proud that Treblinka had the best record for dispensing special treatment of all the camps in Poland. His engineers informed him that it would be impossible to get things into working order again before the train arrived from Warsaw. To make matters worse, both SS Colonel Eichmann and Himmler himself were due on personal inspection tours. Wirth had planned to hold special gassings in their honor. He was forced to round up all the old, obsolete gas vans he could find in the area and send them to the rail siding to meet the train. Generally, the covered vans could accommodate only 20 people, but this was an emergency. By forcing the victims to hold their hands over their heads, the Germans could make space for another 6 or 8 Jews. The Germans discovered that there were still several inches between the tops of the heads and the ceiling of the van. In this space, they packed another 8 or 10 children. Lea Landau was in a daze of grief over Ruth's death as the train pulled to a siding near Treblinka. She and 30 others were taken from the cattle car and forced with whips, clubs, and dogs to get into one of the waiting vans and hold their hands high. When the van held an absolute maximum, the iron door was shut. The truck started into motion. and in a matter of seconds the iron cage was filled with carbon monoxide. Everyone inside the van was dead by the time the trucks entered Treblinka and halted before the open pits where the bodies were unloaded and the gold extracted from the victims' mouths. At least Leah Landau had cheated the Germans, for her gold teeth had been extracted long before and exchanged for food. Winter was coming once again, and the German roundups were becoming more and more frequent. The entire ghetto moved into cellars, taking everything of value with them. The cellars expanded, and some, like the Redeemers, became elaborate bunkers. Dozens, then hundreds of bunkers sprouted, and connecting tunnels began to weave through the earth. The sweeps of the Germans and their Polish Blues and Lithuanians netted fewer and fewer Jews for Treblinka. The Germans became angered. The bunkers were so well concealed they were nearly impossible to locate. At last, the commander of Warsaw himself entered the ghetto one day to speak to the leader of the Jewish Council. He was angry and demanded that the Jewish Council assist the Germans in speeding up the resettlement program by locating the cowards who hid from honest labor. For over 3 years, the Jewish Council had been trapped and torn between carrying out German edicts on the one hand and trying to save their people on the other. Now, shortly after the German demand for assistance, the leader of the Jewish Council committed suicide. It was winter in the ghetto again. Mundek's Redeemers were assigned to plan the defense of a section of the Brushmakers' district. Dov spent his time either in the sewers or in the bunker, forging travel passes. Actually, his trips under the wall allowed him one or two decent meals a week at Wanda's. On his trips out of the ghetto, he now led old people or others unfit for combat. On his trips in, he carried arms and radio parts. During the winter of 1943, the death rate became appalling. Out of an original 500,000 who had been put into the ghetto, only 50,000 were alive by the end of the year. One day in mid-January, Mundek and Rebecca took Dov aside before he was scheduled to descend into the sewer on a trip to Wanda's.
"It seems that we don't have much of a chance just to sit around and talk these days," Mundek said.
"Dov," Rebecca said, "we all talked it over here and took a vote while you were in Warsaw the last time. We have decided that we want you to stay on the other side of the wall."
"You have something special for me to do?"
Dov asked.
"No. You don't understand."
"What do you mean?"
"We mean," Rebecca said, "that we have decided to send certain members out to stay."
Dov didn't understand it. He knew the Redeemers needed him. No one in the entire ZOB knew the sewer routes as well as he did. If the ZOB was preparing to stage a defense, then he would be more valuable than ever. Besides, the papers and travel passes he forged had helped get over 100 people out of Poland. Dov looked at his sister and brother questioningly. Rebecca pressed an envelope into Dov's hands.
"You have money there and papers. Stay with Wanda until she can find you a Christian family to live with."
"You didn't take a vote. This is your idea and Mundek's. I won't go."
"You will go. And that is an order," Mundek said.
"It is not an order,"
Dov answered. "It is an order from me as head of the Landau family."
The three of them stood in the tiny earthen room in one corner of the bunker. It was very quiet.
"It is an order," Mundek repeated.
Rebecca put her arms around Dov and stroked his blonde hair.
"You have grown up, Dov. We have not had much chance to spoil you, have we? I have watched you go into the sewers 100 times, and I have watched you bring us stolen food. We haven't given you much of a boyhood."
"It is not your fault."
"Dov," Mundek said, "please don't deny Rebecca and me this one thing we want. We have not given you much. You must let us try to give you your life."
"Mundek, Rebecca, I don't care as long as I'm with you."
"Please, please, understand us."
One of the Landau family must live. We want you to live for us all.
Dov looked at the brother he worshipped. Mundek's eyes pleaded.
I understand,
Dov whispered.
I will live.
He looked at the package and slipped it into a canvas so that it wouldn't get wet in the sewers. Rebecca crushed his head against her bosom.
We will meet in Eretz Yisrael, she said. Yes, in the land of Yisrael.
You have been a good soldier, Dov,
Mundek said.
I am proud. Shalom Litraot. Shalom Litraot,
Dov repeated. Dov Landau spent his 13th birthday in the sewers beneath Warsaw, waiting to Wanda's apartment with a heart so heavy it nearly broke. In another day and another world, it would have been his bar mitzvah. January 18th, 1943. 3 days after Dov left the ghetto for the temporary safety of Wanda's apartment, the Germans, Polish Blues, and Lithuanians converged on the ghetto. With only 50,000 Jews left, they began rounding up Jews for the final phase of the final solution. The Germans and their cohorts ran into a hail of bullets from ZOB defensive positions. They fled, leaving heavy casualties. The news spread through Warsaw like wildfire. The Jews were staging an uprising. That night, every ear in Warsaw was tuned to the secret ZOB radio, which repeated this appeal over and over and over again.
Fellow Poles, today we struck a blow against tyranny. We ask all our brothers outside the ghetto to arise and strike against the enemy. Join us.
The appeal fell on deaf ears. But from ZOB headquarters on Mila Street, the flag of the Star of David was raised. Alongside it fluttered the flag of Poland. The Jews of the ghetto had chosen to fight to the death beneath a banner which had been denied them in life. Chapter 23. The Germans were chagrined at having been chased from the ghetto. Konrad, Gestapo chief of the ghetto security detail, reported to Hans Frank, the governor of Poland, that the matter would be cleared up in 2 or 3 days. The Polish people, who had been told previously that the Jews were cowards, were now told that the fighting had been the work of a few lunatics and sex deviants, the types who raped Polish girls. ZOB assumed control of the ghetto and disposed of the Jewish council. The fighters made a swift and merciless reprisal on all known collaborators and then moved into set defensive positions. Hans Frank decided he would not play into ZOB's hand by making an attack on the ghetto. The Germans decided to laugh off the attack and minimize it. They cut loose with a propaganda barrage and asked the people of the ghetto to come forth for voluntary resettlement and guaranteed they would be given decent treatment in exchange for honest labor. ZOB issued an order informing the Jews remaining in the ghetto that they would be shot if they conformed with the German request. There would be no more evacuation. After 2 weeks of quiet, the Germans moved patrols in once again to round up Jews. This time they came heavily armed and moved with extreme caution. From carefully prepared positions, the ZOB opened fire. Again, the Germans fled beyond the wall. The Germans decided to think it all over. Their press and radio were indignant over the Jewish Bolsheviks who were causing all the trouble. While the Germans wailed, the ZOB tightened their defensive setups and desperately continued to plead for help from the Polish underground. They expanded their plea to the general public, but no arms came, no underground help came, and only a few dozen volunteers crossed into the ghetto under the wall to fight. The German staff mapped one big crushing assault to wipe out the remains of the ghetto. The day they picked for the attack was the beginning of Passover,
the Jewish holiday celebrated in commemoration of the exodus of the Jews from Egypt under the leadership of Moses. At 3 o'clock in the morning, 3,000 crack SS troops, flanked with Polish Blues and Lithuanians, threw a ring around the entire ghetto. Dozens of searchlights crisscrossed to pick out possible targets for German mortars and light artillery. The barrage lasted until daylight. At dawn, the SS launched their assault over the wall. Converging from several sides, they penetrated deep into the heart of the ghetto without resistance. From hidden barricades, from housetops, from windows, the ZOB, men and women, turned loose a barrage of small arms fire at point-blank range against the trapped and surrounded Germans. For the third time, the Germans scurried from the ghetto. In blind fury, the Germans came back into the ghetto with tanks, and the tanks were met with a storm of gasoline-filled bottles which turned the iron monsters into flaming coffins. With the tanks disabled, the German SS troops were forced to flee again. This time they left several hundred dead in the streets. The ZOB fighters rushed out of hiding to take the German guns as well as their uniforms. Konrad was dismissed, and SS General Stroop was called in to take command. He was ordered to destroy the ghetto so thoroughly that no one would ever again dare challenge the power of the Nazis. Stroop mounted attack after attack, day after day. Each new attack utilized a different strategy and hit from a different direction. Each attack and each patrol met the same fate. They were repulsed by the ZOB, whose members fought like madmen. House by house, room by room, step by step, they refused to be taken alive. Homemade landmines and booby traps, violent counterattacks, raw courage beat the Germans out of the ghetto every time they entered. 10 days passed, and the Germans were desperate for a victory. They made a concerted attack on the ghetto's lone hospital, entered, shot every patient, blew up the building, and claimed they had destroyed ZOB headquarters. ZOB teams dressed in uniforms of German soldiers they had killed and used this device to trick, trap, and ambush their enemy. They crossed out of the ghetto time and time again to hit the Germans from the rear by raiding their arsenals. The Germans continued their attacks and soon, by the sheer weight of their numbers and arms, made themselves felt. The ZOB could not replace a fallen fighter. Once a defensive position was destroyed, there was no choice but to retrench. They could not replace ammunition as fast as they were expending it. Still, with the power on their side, the Germans were unable to get a foothold inside the ghetto. ZOB began calling upon many of the Jews not in fighting units to escape into Warsaw, for there were not enough rifles to go around. Wearing a captured uniform, Mundek led an attack on the Pawiak prison and freed all the inmates. The 3-day cleanup Konrad had promised had stretched into 2 weeks. On the 15th day after the first German assault, Rebecca Landau was fighting in a building in the Brushmakers district, a few blocks from Redeemer headquarters. A direct mortar hit killed every defender but her. Under sustained mortar fire, the walls of the building collapsed and she was forced into the street. As the Germans closed in on her and cut off all possibilities of retreat, she reached beneath her dress and withdrew a hand grenade. Running at 3 Germans, she pulled the pin and killed them and herself. After 3 weeks, Stroop was forced to change his tactics. He had drawn heavy casualties, and the Nazis were unable to cover up the valiant action of the Jews with propaganda. Stroop pulled his troops back, reinforced the ring of men and armor surrounding the ghetto, and declared a state of siege. He brought in heavy artillery, which blasted into the ghetto at near point-blank range, in a determined effort to knock down all the buildings which the Jews had used so well as defensive positions. By night, Heinkel bombers saturated the ghetto area with incendiary bombs. Mundek returned to the Redeemer bunker after a staff meeting at ZOB headquarters. He and his fighters were half dead with exhaustion, hunger, and thirst. Many were badly burned. They gathered around him.
German artillery has knocked down just about every building. What is standing is burning, he said.
Have we been able to establish contact with the underground?
Oh, yes. We've made contact. But they aren't going to help us. We cannot expect any more food, ammunition, or water than what we have on hand. Our communications are about ruined. In short, my friends, we can no longer fight according to a fixed plan. Each bunker is on its own. We will try to keep contact with ZOB through runners, but we will each plan and execute our own ambushes and encounters with the Germans when they come back.
How long can we hold out like this, Mundek? We have only 30 people left and 10 pistols and 6 rifles.
Mundek smiled.
All of Poland held out for only 26 days. We have done that well already.
Mundek assigned his guards, rationed what little food was left, and mapped out a dawn patrol. Rivka, one of the girls, picked up a battered accordion and began playing a soft, slow tune. In that dank and slimy bunker 10 feet beneath the earth, the remaining Redeemers sang in a strange and wistful blend of voices. They sang a song that they had learned as children at Redeemer meetings. The song told them that the land in Galilee, in Eretz Yisrael, was beautiful, and that wheat grew in the fields, and the grain bent softly in the wind. In a bunker in the Warsaw ghetto, they sang of the fields of Galilee that they knew they would never see.
Alert!
A sentry called down as he spotted a lone figure weaving in and out of the flames and rubble. The lights went out and the bunker became black and silent. There was a knock in code. The door opened and closed, and the lights were turned on again.
Dov, for God's sake, what are you doing here? Don't send me away again, Mundek.
The two brothers embraced, and Dov wept. It felt good to have Mundek's arms around him again. Everyone gathered